So quickly before we begin, we're all coming to terms with our new realities at the moment. Some of the interviews you'll be hearing were conducted before we were dealing with an official pandemic. But over the coming few weeks, as we continue to speak to entrepreneurs and our guests, I'll look to find out how they're coping with the repercussions to their businesses, and hopefully we'll all find something we can learn from their solutions. In the meantime, I hope you'll find something interesting to listen to among the podcasts that we do. Of course, there's this and the past seasons of Tales of the Trade. You might also be aware that we do a monthly documentary called Karama Sutra. And among our partner shows, Forward Talks by Gombook is the one to listen to for all things sustainability. And in the latest episode of the Lighthouse Conversations, which is focused on arts and culture, you'll find a recording of our live episode with UAE Minister of State Zaki Nasiba, who shared his journey and his outlook. And we hope to continue bringing you more episodes to keep you company in this time. One final thing, from all of us here at Amaya Media, we hope that you stay safe and keep everyone around you safe as well. These are trying times, but it's important that we not panic, keep exercising caution, and work with the relevant authorities as they continue to take precautionary measures for our own safety.
Of course, when I started Nabish, I didn't have all of these things in my mind, and you know, I just kind of faced them. Now, if I'm to build a tech startup, I'll do it obviously completely differently.
But would you build a tech startup again?
No.
That's the real question there.
You know what? No, actually, it's not the right answer. Maybe.
From Amaya Media, you're listening to Tales of the Trade, where we feature Dubai's entrepreneurs and pioneers, and the stories not just behind the companies, but also the communities they brought to life. I'm Chirag Desai. Now, on this season of the show, we've been focusing on operating and scaling a business. Once you've qualified your idea, put out your business plan, raked up the funds, how do you keep a business running over the next few years? How do you take it to the 3-year, the 5-year, the 10-year milestone? Today's episode is about one such journey, so pull up a chair and join our conversation with Lulu Kazan, founder of Nabish. As a young girl growing up in Lebanon, Lulu had a strong desire to be independent, something she felt she couldn't achieve if she continued to stay in the country.
Yeah, and Lebanon was, you know, we went through like 3 to 4 years of war, if you put them like all together. It was like a terrifying experience. You know, when I was in my teens, I just wanted to get out. I wanted to go to a different place. I wanted to be on my own. I didn't want to live with my family. You know, I wanted to be independent. And I went to Australia. I convinced my father to send me to Australia for hospitality management course.
How hard was that?
Convincing the course?
No, the convincing him.
The convincing, I don't think it was very hard because I had a good pitch. I went prepared and I told my father, you know, we don't come from like wealth at all. And I told my father, look, you give me a one-way ticket to Australia. The fees for the first semester. And I can work, you know, because it's hospitality management, you can actually study and work and make money at the same time. So I won't need any further funding. And he agreed. Plus, you know, he gets to like live with that conflict for a while, like with that conflict with me. I don't know. I don't know if he was conservative. I don't know how to describe it. But, you know, there was always conflict, like anytime I wanted to do something and so on, which is quite normal, like, when I was growing up in the Middle East.
So at the age of 17, Lulu landed in Sydney, a whole 24-hour flight away from home.
My university was actually in an area called the Blue Mountains, which is 2 hours by train away from Sydney. And it was in like a village which had less than what my village had in Lebanon. there was a culture shock for sure. The university was pretty cool because it was so international. Like we had people from Sweden, from China, from South Korea, from India, from like all over, like the US, from all over the place, which was like super cool. And I worked, you know, some very humbling jobs. Like I worked at the laundry. I worked as a waitress in restaurants. I worked as a night auditor. I think that was the worst.
A night auditor?
Night auditor. A night auditor is basically a receptionist at a hotel, but you have the night shift. So you're on from 11 p.m. till 7 a.m. Yeah, I did 6 months of that. I think that was probably one of the worst jobs I've done, like, in my life ever. And I'm, like, almost 40 now. So, I mean, I don't regret any of it, you know? I mean, I'm not even working in hospitality today.
Lulu did move back to Lebanon after her degree, but she lasted just 4 months this time. She quickly then moved to Dubai and started working within the hospitality industry here, but that only lasted 9 months.
My first job was sales and marketing executive at a hotel, and my salary was, if I remember, it was either 3,000 or 3,250 a month, something like that. Yeah, and it was a six day a week type job. And I couldn't stand it.
So that's the 9 months you were saying that you
that's
were still
the nine
in hospital.
Months. Yeah, that's the 9 months. I couldn't stand it. I mean, it was better than the night auditor job.
That is still the worst point.
Because it was like physically hard. You imagine like having to be up all night, yeah, terrible. And sleeping during the day. It was like terrible. But that is like the second. It was really hard because like a lot of my friends here in Dubai were in the corporate, like, you know, working for companies, and they had, you know, 2 day weekends, and they were on like at least like triple my salary at the time. And I was working 6 days, longer hours, and like crappy salary. I was like, oh, okay, man, that's got to change.
So she started reaching out to her network and ended up pivoting her career. In 2003, Lulu started working for Daimler Chrysler Financial Services.
I kind of like threw myself into studying finance and doing project management courses. And I was very lucky because the head of that company at the time was a relative of a close friend, and he was like, he became like my first mentor, and he was like an amazing person. He always, you know, gave me interesting projects with exposure, invested in like training and all of that, which was, you know, I'm eternally grateful. I mean, because, you know, he took a bet on me coming out of the hospitality industry into the corporate
and that too in financial world. Services, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And obviously things changed. My career changed since that day, since I did that like shift. And luckily I haven't had to resort back to hospitality. Anyway, I'm like probably the worst person to carry a tray. I mean, I'll probably drop all the drinks on you if I have to carry something. So it's not like I was...
The hospitality industry hasn't lost, is what you're trying to say.
No. No, so yeah, it wasn't my forte, let's put it this way.
Now, as you're aware, in 2008, the global financial crisis hit, which meant Lulu landed up losing her job. But this almost turned into a blessing, as she started working for a startup advisory service called ActiveM, giving her a close look at the entrepreneurship space for about 3 years, which is when she felt ready to start something on her own.
When I left ActiveM, I didn't have an idea. I was studying to do my CFA level one.
Okay,
exam.
So you were still in thinking in the same space at the time.
I wanted to do an MBA, okay, but then it was like too expensive. And then one of my friends told me, why don't you do the CFA? And I'm like, fine. Not knowing how hard it was.
Yeah.
And I passed it, and it was like, you know, like it was a huge achievement for me because, yeah, it was quite difficult from someone from my kind of academic background. When I finished the CFA, I'm like, okay, right now I need to like find some project work because I need to get paid and make some money, and I want to stay in the work. You know, in the work mindset, like I don't want to be sitting at home trying to figure things out. And this is how the idea for Nabish, you know, started to kind of form. I was like, okay, there's probably like millions of people like me. They don't want to work full time. They want to make money. They want to work, but at their own pace, at their own, of their own choosing. And I'm like, oh, okay. Well, there's nothing like that in this part of the world. I mean, the only, you know, the only options available were like full-time jobs, websites.
So this is a time where we're not an active part-time economy, really.
Not at all, yeah.
There were a couple of more international sites or platforms like this where you could connect with freelancers. Was that something that you looked at as a model to be like, okay, well, this is kind of what's working
no,
there?
No, I didn't even, I mean, I wasn't even aware of the international platforms initially. Plus, I didn't feel the international platforms were what I wanted anyway.
In what way?
So the international platforms are focused a lot on like, you know, tech, design, copywriting, these types of skills. It's not really what I wanted. I wanted like consulting, pretty much, which was slightly different than me kind of working on a task. So the initial days of Nabish, I mean, the initial idea of Nabish was, it was a platform to help people monetize their skills and their hobbies. So actually, the early days of Nabish, you could add your hobbies as well. So for example, let's say you were an engineer and you're a podcaster by night.
Entirely a generic example, nothing to do with how I started Amaya Media, by the way.
The idea was, you can make enough income, hopefully, so that you are financially independent. It always goes back to financial like independence. And I felt that, you know, who would benefit from this platform? Women. Obviously, it's not a secret, but a lot of women drop out of the workforce after they have a family. So I felt that, you know, they can benefit from this. University students can build, you know, the worst thing for a university student, I think, is when you graduate and you have to work on your CV and you're like, oh my God, what do I put on there? And you start digging into, oh, I was like a head of scouts, or I don't know, like I did this voluntary project, or I sold lemonade, or whatever you did.
So Lulu sat down with her idea and put together a strategy document about Nabish, and then went about to collect one more ingredient, momentum.
When you want to start something, and this is something I do all the time, like I try to talk to a lot of people about it, and that gives me momentum. Like, for example, you know, with Nabish, when I started talking to a few people about it, like my husband and some close friends, and then immediately I went and I found like a small boutique agency in Lebanon, and we started developing the brand, and we started developing the screens, basically, of the platform, the UI. And they were a group of like four or five people at the time. And, you know, we started like talking about go-to-market, and like one of the co-founders of the agency, you know, she was like a great comms person, and she like went with me to universities, and we did some booth and platforms. So you start kind of gathering momentum, and then I outsourced the development part to an agency, which didn't work. Then I hired someone, and it didn't work. And
I've come across this a few times as well, like when I talk to entrepreneurs who are trying to build stuff, is that when if the tech is the main part of your business, like outsourcing it just somehow doesn't work.
Yeah,
and if it's something that's it's an add-on or something complementary, then it's fine. Like it's an app doing something for you. Mm. That's one thing. But if it's like the key element of your platform.
Well, I mean, a lot of people have to outsource, right? Like Kareem outsourced their tech initially. I mean, sometimes you don't have an option. If you don't have a tech co-founder.
Yeah, what do you do?
You don't have an option. So you have to outsource it and hope for the best. You know, things are a lot different today than back in 2011. Now you can get a lot of referrals from startups that have worked with some of these tech houses, maybe in India or in other places. But it's definitely a risk.
So how did you pick the one that you went to?
I think I met with like two or three agencies at the time.
They were based here?
No, they were based in Lebanon. And I picked one, I think it was Price, probably, as a main driver. And I really liked the guys at the time as well that were running that agency. It didn't work out, not because like they did a mistake or whatever. I think the problem with non-tech founders, and again, at least talking, you know, 9 years ago, when there wasn't that much awareness about startups and technology and all of that, is there is often a mismatch in expectations. So you expect something, and you have no idea how hard it is to kind of implement when it comes when it comes to the development side. So you come up with like a list of features. Oh, let's build this and let's do that. And obviously not knowing what it takes and not knowing what it takes to change those features if something's not working. So unfortunately, I didn't have that like mindset of, you know, let's go super light and MVP and so on, which is like very common today, put it this way. So I don't blame anybody. And I don't blame myself because obviously, you know, I didn't know at the time what I know today. So it was all a learning process.
So in early 2012, Nabesh launched an alpha version. That's the one that comes even before the beta. It was essentially a basic directory. There were no real payment options or workflows.
And this is when I went into the Entrepreneur Show, which was like a startup competition, televised startup competition show. And I won. And I won $1 million.
So that $1 million, which is about $270,000, gave Nabesh the breathing room it needed to build out the platform. She hadn't quite solved the original tech problem, though. And as she was talking to a friend about exactly that, he introduced her to his tech person, Rima Olsheikh.
He told me, like, she can, you know, take a look and, like, give you some advice. And we connected, and, like, she really liked, you know, what I was building. And eventually, a few months later, she's like, you know, I really like this. I really want to jump into this. This looks very exciting and stuff. So, and she did. In the middle of the year, in the middle of 2012, she joined and came on board. My friend was like super pissed at me for like a really long time.
Was that because you took her away?
Well, I didn't really take her away. It just really happened, you know. I mean, we were kind of like bouncing ideas, and I was showing her, and I think she saw me like suffering with the technology, and she felt she was drawn to the vision, and she felt that she wanted to be part of it. And like, I apologized many times. We're good now.
Yeah.
It took like a year or a couple of years maybe, but
wow,
I think
he was really.
I think we're fine now.
You think so? You're not sure?
No. I think I haven't seen him in a while actually, yeah. But yeah, I think we're good. I mean, that's another thing. Like, I don't like to burn bridges. And if I did something, I'm okay to apologize and say, you know, I did a mistake here. So yeah, and then all of a sudden I had a co-founder and things started to change a little bit and to the better, obviously. And then a few years later, I lost my co-founder and carried on.
When we come back, how Nabesh found its tech backbone and became the tech platform that allows you to connect to over 100,000 individuals today. Stay with us. Hey, it's Chirag, and I want to thank you so much for listening to our show and supporting us. As you know, we work a lot with local businesses and partners who've been great in supporting us and our shows. You normally hear their ads here. And in these times, we've been thinking about how we could support them back. So today, I want to share a little bit about the Courtyard Playhouse. They're a lovely family-owned community theater, which we featured in season one. And today, with the precautionary measures in place, they can no longer conduct their workshops and classes. So they're asking for the community support to raise funds, which will help them with their overheads and expenses. In the show notes, you'll find a link where you can donate. And on their behalf, I ask if you can even spare 100 dirhams. That's roughly about $25, because every little bit helps them right now. In the show notes, you'll also find a link to their full episode if you want to get to know them better. And you can connect with them directly on Instagram at the Courtyard Playhouse. As I mentioned, every little bit helps, and I hope you'll really consider supporting them. Welcome back. You're listening to Tales of the Trade from Amaya Media. So after winning $1 million in funding and Rima coming on board with Nabesh, they started from scratch, stripping down to the existing database and rebuilding it from the ground up.
It was like a very pretty version of LinkedIn, let's put it this way. I mean, our community was growing tremendously, but we weren't monetizing for a while.
Yeah.
We couldn't monetize for a while. But we had, you know, like the service worked, you know.
And you had a bit of capital going in, so
and
it wasn't like
capital,
you had a little bit of runtime before you had to worry about it.
And by the way, we weren't monetizing, not because we didn't want to monetize, but because things took so long to build at the time. And again, this was one of my frustrations.
And that frustration actually came back in 2014 when Rima left the company.
It's I don't usually go into the details, honestly, of that story, but clearly it's not a good story.
Yeah.
You know, we saw things differently, and she felt that she wanted to work on many startups, on different things. So we kind of agreed that it's probably best to not to work together.
At that point in 2014, when you'd kind of been working on this and you put everything in context and you'd gotten here and you'd found the co-founder and you'd won the competition and all of it was kind of finally panning out.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, that can't have been
a huge blow.
Yeah.
Huge blow. No,
did you consider shutting down?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. It was a huge blow. But then, you know, I don't know, it's like with entrepreneurs, you keep going, you have some kind of, you see like a tiny, tiny light somewhere in the tunnel and you're like, you know what, let me keep going. And I think the reason why I kept going is because I still believed in the vision of what we were building. Maybe the components weren't working. I had like problems kind of all over the place, but I still believed that what we're building is useful, is needed, and has impact, and that's kind of what kept me going. I love NetBush, you know. I kind of loved NetBush from like day one, and with all of the ups and downs, let's say, I still love the idea of NetBush and what we set out to do. And I just think that some of the issues are very much about, you know, getting the market to kind of accept freelancing and the gig economy as
an okay thing, as a normal thing.
As a normal thing, yeah.
Did you keep building while you were doing this?
Oh no, I couldn't keep building. I mean, this was a time where, you know, we were four, I think, at the time.
And she was handling the tech at that.
Yeah,
at
she
that
was
point,
handling
so,
the tech,
yeah.
And we had other engineers as well. We had two engineers. And her, and those engineers were like based in Lebanon, and yeah, it was horrible. It was horrible because obviously I like, for me to sort of try to manage them and figure out like what was going on, and other than the obviously the emotional stress of having someone leave, you know, someone at that level leave, everything was kind of paused, yeah, considered closing down, and because I felt that you know, to keep building, basically I had to kind of redo things all over again, and I didn't know that if we'd be able to do that.
During that year from 2014 to 2015, after dealing with the lows, Lulu went back to that key ingredient that she'd relied on when she started NetBush: momentum. With a steadfast love for what she was doing, she kept talking to people who reminded her of how powerful her platform had been in actually connecting people. And Lulu took that momentum to go out and raise money for NetBush again.
I knew that finding someone on the technology and rebuilding that the tech part of the business, let's say, putting things back in order, let's put it this way, and then growing the business and spending on marketing and scaling the business needs funding. In 2015, beginning of 2015, I did an A round of 1.1 million and managed to rebuild the team. But it took time. So I lost a lot of time.
All of this didn't solve that original dilemma. Who was going to take care of the tech?
Even though it's very, mathematical, like even though you can pretty much say, okay, it should take me this long to build this because I'm going to put in so and so lines of code and I don't know, whatever.
Doesn't pan out like that.
It's still subjective. Like, because if you talk to two different developers, you're going to get a different answer. And this is, you know, this is, I think, a massive challenge for people that have non-tech backgrounds coming into tech. And of course, when I started NetBush, I didn't have all of these things in my mind, and you know, I just kind of faced them. Now, if I'm to build a tech startup, I'll do it obviously completely differently.
But would you build a tech startup again?
No.
that's the real question there.
You know what? No, actually, it's not the right answer, maybe. And I'll tell you why. Because in 2015, I hired a CTO, okay, a Greek guy called Sotiris. And I love the guy. He's one of my favorite people. And the guy is a great communicator. He's very honest. He's very loyal. He's very dedicated. And I would definitely work with him again. But to find him
takes a long time.
Took me years.
You brought him on as a CTO.
Yeah.
You didn't bring him on as a partner or something else.
No.
I'm assuming that was an intentional decision, considering the experience. How do you feel about a co-founder?
I would partner up with Sotiris in a heartbeat. Yeah, he's an amazing person. There's quite a few people that I worked with at Nabush that I would partner with in a heartbeat. But I think it takes time to build these relationships and that trust. And sometimes if you're a first time founder, unless you're bringing in friends and people that you've worked with before, which obviously also has its own
risks.
But unless you bring in people that you've worked with before, you're going to have to go through this painful learning experience, you know. It's like, you know, when you're working in a company and you get a new CEO, and sometimes you have a lot of reshuffling, you know, and people leave, and then the people of the CEO kind of join. And it's normal, because sometimes you want to work with people that you can trust. And it's the same for me. If I were to do another startup, I would probably want to work with the people I've worked with, because they're fantastic. Not all of them, but some of them.
Once you brought your platform up to par, you also have to look at sustaining the business and taking it to its next milestone. And in a market that's not formally conducive to the gig economy, Nabush also has to keep evolving its business model.
So the marketplace doesn't do well, let's say, from a financial standpoint. The way we make our money today is by working with larger clients on providing them with freelance talent or contractors, let's say, for long-term projects, or let's say medium to long-term projects. We still work with clients as well on brand guidelines or an identity project. But most of the money comes from long-term projects. So the marketplace has basically smaller jobs, I want to do a logo, or I want to do a brochure or something like that. But because these jobs aren't very high in value, so we don't really make a lot of money on that. So the money comes from building relations with larger clients, which honestly I think is what this market needs, because not many people know what they want when it comes to freelancers, especially when it comes to these types of skills and these types of talent. So if you want to build if you're an SME and you want to build a website, you have no clue. Like, you think, I'm going to hire a developer and that person's going to build the whole thing for me. They don't understand that, no, you need design. You need copywriting. You need photos. You know, you need a video. And no, the developer is not going to build it all for you. You have to tell them, how many pages you want on the website and all of that. So when we work closely with clients today, we were able to guide them and act almost as an advisor, and recommend basically the right people. And it works.
You raised $1 million and 1.1. So start of 2015. Have you raised since then?
No.
You haven't needed to?
No. So currently the company is sustainable, and our growth is organic, and we have a lot of repeat clients and word of mouth, and that's how we function today. I think the market needs a lot of educating, and that requires a big investment. So what worked is that, we're not selling luxury products, or we're not selling things that people don't need.
Actually, it works better for you. I mean, in a way, if things are slowing down economically, then the demand for freelancers and sort of part-timers and all these things should ideally go up.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, in theory, in when things are slow, yes, the demand should increase. So yes, we saw demand increasing in certain industries. So for example, like the advertising agencies, creative agencies, we know that they've, you know, let go a lot of people, and we know that there is a big demand on, let's say, creative talent. Yeah. But again, when it comes to the, I mean, and these are industries that are accustomed to working with freelancers. It's like part of their, you know, model. But the SMEs, which I believe where the bulk is and where the growth would be, I don't think they know how to work with freelancers, or it's not like part of how they do business.
And you're still not cracking that?
We still haven't cracked that, no. I think the freelancers, the SMEs need... So what we're doing today with the big companies, this is what the SMEs need.
So this might be why, let's say, when you were looking at this idea, there was nothing. And potentially why today there isn't a big competitor,
yeah,
perhaps?
Absolutely.
Right?
I mean, you know, what I learned was the idea for Nebbish was to create a marketplace that connects people remotely. But what we discovered throughout the years is that people want the face-to-face here. So remote is not really accepted, which obviously went against everything, like, you know, I had built. Yeah. And we had to like readjust. And people here don't trust people remotely. They want to meet the guy or the girl face-to-face. They want to shake hands. They want to see them physically sitting in their office. So that's how also why our model had to change. This business is, I think the issue here as well, other than the market and the mentality and the culture, is also the funding. Like this business requires a lot of funding to kind of get to a point where, let's say, you're on like a scale trajectory. Because you have several issues that you want to solve. You have quality issues you want to solve. You have to moderate. You have to vet. You have to educate. So I don't know. I don't think, I haven't seen an appetite, let's say, here from the investor community to kind of put money into this.
So what's next for you now?
So what's next is... that's a very deep question, by the way. It's a deep question because, like, I'm at a time where I'm kind of reviewing options, and I have a lot of options at the table. So, I definitely want to kind of grow the conversations with Lulu podcast. I feel that this is something that should keep going, irrespective of what else I'm doing with my life. Why? Because it gives me an opportunity to meet some. Reconnect with amazing people that I know and meet with new people and have great discussions. And I can learn from that process and I can share that learning with, you know, the wider community. So I think that podcast track is gonna continue at least up until I feel that it doesn't work. I'm doing angel investing.
Okay.
So I still love startups love meeting founders. Again, when I'm doing angel investing, I kind of learn a lot about a new industry and a new business. So I've put together a group of close friends, and we have a small angel network. We've done 5 investments in 2019. Hopefully we'll do maybe another 4 or 5 this year.
Hey, there's a podcast company you're interested in. I might know somebody.
Okay. So I'm doing that, and that's exciting. Nebbish is still there, so I'm also doing that. And there's some, you know, hopefully some announcements soon on that front. And then we'll see. But I'm definitely going to stay in the startup space and in that kind of ecosystem because I love it. I love meeting new people. I love learning about new ideas. I love seeing how things are built and how things work. I love kind of knowing, getting into the details and from the ground up. I like that.
Nebbish today boasts over 100,000 individuals that you can look to hire. You can find out more at nebbesh.com. The premiere episode of Lulu's podcast, Conversations with Lulu, features the co-founder of the region's largest streaming platform, Angami. You can find it in all of your podcast players. Once again, I'd like to ask that you consider donating to Co-Chair Playhouse and helping them reach their funding target by following the link in our show notes. This episode of Tales of the Trade was hosted and produced by me, Chirag Desai, with support from Abhishek Venkatasubramanian, Sukena Kazmi, and Zainab Ujjaini. Original music was composed by Rainer Erlings. Tales of the Trade is part of the Amaya Media Network. You can find out more at amaya.media and connect with us on Instagram at amaya.media or talesofthe.trade. We're in all of your podcast players, so you can catch up on this and the previous seasons of the show in Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Deezer, and Angami.